Lecture 17, Covert Operations and Codes in World War II.
One of the most famous secret agents in World War II was a man who never existed. This is how he went into action. In the early morning hours of April 30th, 1943, a British submarine was bobbing up and down in the tides off the coast of Spain. Only the officers were on deck, and they helped to set a man's body into the water, where currents would bring it to the Spanish beaches. The body bore identification that this was Major Martin of the Royal Marines. No such person existed. The body of a homeless man had been picked up for the purpose, dressed in uniform and a life jacket, and provided with carefully manufactured dog tags, money, old theater tickets, and personal letters. In a briefcase handcuffed to the body were military plans about a coming Allied invasion. British radio news announced that a plane with British officers had been lost at sea. Later that day, a Spanish fisherman found the body. The Spanish authorities informed British diplomats, but they moved slowly to retrieve the body. Nazi spies were tipped off first and photographed the contents of the briefcase. Would the Nazis believe this seeming coup of theirs? The lives of many Allied soldiers depended on this, a deceptive message carried by a man who had never existed. Let us begin with an examination of the shadow war that ran in parallel with the great battlefield engagements and the movements of armies across the map of the Second World War. The hope was that special operations, carried out in covert ways, could tip the balance of this epochal conflict. The balance seemed especially endangered early in the war, when France fell with unexpected speed in June 1940, crumpling in the face of German blitzkrieg and French demoralization. Now Britain stood alone. What was to be done? The new Prime Minister, Winston Churchill, looked back to historical precedent, back to the strategy that had worked in the wars against Napoleon, of seeking a peripheral strategy, not a direct attack against the enemy, but on the sides, fomenting revolts, as in the campaigns against Napoleon on the Iberian Peninsula. Weeks after the surrender of France, in July 1940, Churchill ordered his military to set Europe ablaze with sabotage and British encouragement for underground resistance movements in Nazi-occupied Europe. This was the impetus for the founding of the new organization called the Special Operations Executive, SOE. The new organization would exist in a constant and latent rivalry with MI6, which was in charge of espionage networks. Here's another constant that we see in intelligence activities. Even branches that are working on the same side can suspect one another and get in each other's way. In the German case, the Abwehr military intelligence had the same tensions and frictions with its Nazi counterpart, the SD, or Security Service. The SOE operated far and wide, encouraging resistance movements in France, the Netherlands, Scandinavia, Africa, the Middle East, the Balkans, and East Asia. At its maximum size, it had about 13,000 men and women, and its daring activities were said to be especially irksome to Hitler. But along with its successes in encouraging resistance and sabotage, the SOE also experienced some keen disappointments. Let me mention one in particular. On March 6, 1942, the German military intelligence Abwehr captured an SOE agent, the Dutchman Hubert Lauwers, whom the British had infiltrated back into occupied Holland. Lauwers was carrying a transmitter, and the Germans forced him to send disinformation back to the SOE to bring further drops of men as well as supplies. However, each radio operator has unique signs and his or her own style, and security routines are built into such communication. However, the SOE radio operators back in Britain did not notice a change in Lauer's broadcasting, and further drops followed, and these led to the capture of more than 50 agents by the Nazis, most of them shot. Eventually, in desperation at this unfolding tragedy, Lauwers even slipped a coded message into his transmissions. At the start of one message, he included the letters C-A-U, and at the end of the message, G-H-T, to spell out caught, to indicate what had happened to him. But the SOE missed this hint as well. For about a year, the Nazis subverted the British plans for Holland and killed a series of SOE agents before the British suspected that something was wrong. Fortunately, not all radio operators in Britain were this careless. In another case, a radio operator suspected from those telltale hints that a message received from occupied Europe was fake, that it was actually being typed out by a German Morse code operator, not the agent who was allegedly sending it. To trick his counterpart into revealing this, this British operator ended the message really quickly with a sign-off HH, which stood for Heil Hitler. And immediately, in return, before the German operator could stop himself, he got the HH signal in reply. Being on automatic, rather than constantly being alert, can be dangerous in the sphere of covert operations. Another problem also dogged the SOE, as it does, for that matter, all armed underground resistance movements. It was this: strikes against the Nazi occupiers would provoke a terrible revenge, often against the civilian population. When sabotage took place, the Nazis shot hostages from the local populace. Armed attacks could mean reprisals against entire towns and villages, and this proved a tremendous moral quandary. Let me give an example concretely. In 1942, the SOE parachuted into occupied Europe two Czech commandos who assassinated one of the most feared and notorious of the Nazi leaders, Reinhard Heydrich, the head of Himmler's Central Security Agency, the RSHA, the planner of genocide, and the chief of occupied Bohemia, as Heydrich was on his way to Prague. The Nazis responded by rounding up all the men of the Czech village of Lidice and executing them all. Now, morally, of course, in this entire dynamic, the ultimate choice lay with the brutal occupiers. But the calculus of cost and benefit in such guerrilla warfare was a difficult one. When the United States joined the Second World War in December 1941 after Pearl Harbor, the SOE soon had a counterpart in its ally, the American Office of Strategic Services, or OSS, which had been founded June 13, 1942. The OSS was led by William J. Donovan, known by his nickname Wild Bill. Wild Bill Donovan was an ardent Republican born in Buffalo, New York. He was a high-powered New York lawyer when the First World War had broken out and went on to become one of the most highly decorated Americans of the war, including a Medal of Honor. In July 1941, Donovan was made the coordinator of information, reporting intelligence to FDR. This office eventually became the OSS in June of the next year. As this organization was built up, it too encountered opposition from another agency, J. Edgar Hoover's FBI, because Hoover wanted the FBI to be put in charge of counterintelligence abroad. And tensions would linger afterwards between these agencies. But the die was now cast. The OSS was the first U.S. worldwide intelligence service. The new OSS had some 10,000 operatives. Among them was an entire run of future CIA directors. Another person in the OSS ranks deserves special mention, in part because the image we have of her as a secret operative is so wildly at odds with the cheerful and open public persona which she later crafted for herself. This was the future famous chef on countless television shows, Julia Child, who did so much to popularize French cooking in America. Intelligent and strikingly tall, once she was employed by the OSS, they recognized her unique talents. And she soon found herself involved in projects that ranged from concocting shark repellent for use in the war to managing personnel issues. She served in Washington, then in British India, and in China. It was at this point that she was still named Julia McWilliams, and she met her future husband, Paul Child, through her work because he was also an OSS agent. Along with the serious missions of the OSS were some ideas which were simply crazy. Some of these were labeled Operation Cornflakes. Now, I need to mention here that the best tradecraft and experience in espionage stipulates that the cover name of an operation should be as random as possible, with no direct link between the name and the content of the operation, so that if someone inadvertently on the enemy side learned the name of an operation, they wouldn't be able to just to guess what it actually was all about. In this case, however, Operation Cornflakes, its name might have been a tip-off that the operation was pretty flaky. The operation involved trying to undermine the morale of the German home front by psychological warfare. And this included, for instance, the project of creating parody versions of real German stamps and then smuggling them back into Germany. For instance, stamps were created by the OSS that didn't have Hitler on them as they should have as the main leader, but instead Heinrich Himmler. And this was supposed to deviously sow rivalry and dissension among the top Nazi leadership. Another famous example was a stamp of Hitler, which was as it should be in Nazi Germany, but a stamp of Hitler with half of his face eaten away so that one could see the skull emerging from under the skin. And this stamp would be labeled not as it usually was, Deutsches Reich, German Empire, but instead, in sort of an awkward pun, Futsches Reich, or defunct empire. This really didn't produce much of an effect. You can imagine or guess exactly what happened to such propaganda items when they made their way into Germany. People simply threw them away from fear of being found by the Gestapo with incriminating evidence. Another OSS operation included the idea of sending incendiary bats to Japan. These little bats, outfitted with tiny backpacks that would start fires, were supposed to seek shelter in Japan's many wooden structures and eventually burn the entire country down. Surprisingly, this too didn't work. If the bats had, however, been able to report back with intelligence to the Americans, that would have been the initiation of a new branch of intelligence gathering alongside Humint and SIGINT, in this case, BATINT. Overall, however, Donovan and his team had great pride in what was accomplished and hoped that the OSS would continue even after the crisis of the war was passed. President Truman saw things differently, and he shut down the OSS on September 20th, 1945, a month or so after Japan was defeated. Then, 2 years later, Truman probably wished he had not shut it down, because a new organization had to be established, the CIA, with many OSS veterans staffing it. A key task for all of these intelligence agencies would be deception and disinformation, to cloak in falsehood the real facts of Allied operations as they were put into effect. The always eloquent Winston Churchill probably put it best. He said that, in wartime, truth is so precious that she should always be attended by a bodyguard of lies. A bodyguard of lies. This famous aphorism on covert activities stands as an almost exact counterpoint to Stimson's famous absolutist motto from the 1920s that we discussed in earlier lectures about gentlemen not reading each other's mail. Could gentlemen lie to one another then? Churchill's insight, moreover, was not a fundamentally new one. Recall from the very start of our course how the Chinese philosopher Sun Tzu had insisted that all warfare is based on deception. Among the British intelligence agencies that were working full-time on misleading the enemy was a man who would later become famous for other reasons. In room 39 of the Admiralty building in London, one room over from the famous room 40 of the cryptologists of World War I, in the Naval Intelligence Division sat a man whose task was to dream up covert operations and deceptions. That man's name was Ian Fleming. Later, as the author of the James Bond series, he would be doing much the same thing, but in the much nicer setting of Jamaica and for far better pay. Another British agency concocted one of the most elaborate, long-running, and successful deceptions in history, with fateful consequences. This was the so-called 20 Committee, which had been set up in January of 1941. The name itself was a sort of heavy-handed pun, as 20 rendered in Roman numerals is XX, or a double cross. This program deceived the German intelligence by capturing, turning, or mimicking all of the German spies sent to England. Before 1940, the Germans had infiltrated about 70 agents into Britain, some before the war broke out. Another 100 arrived during the war. Almost every one of these agents working for Germany was captured and turned in the process of a disinformation campaign staged by the British. The most significant of these putative Nazi agents was the 29-year-old Spaniard, Juan Pujol Garcia, who was codenamed Garbo. He had volunteered for these duties, although at first British intelligence had been skeptical and had turned him away. After the British turned him away, on his own initiative, this man volunteered to work for the German Abwehr, the military intelligence, and then went back to the British to tell them that he had now made contact with the Germans. This was a man who would not take no for an answer. Garbo eventually had in Britain an entire stable of 27 totally fake agents, all of whom passed carefully vetted fake information to Germany with just enough truthful detail to make them credible to the enemy. A further powerful weapon in the war was the Allied cracking of German and Japanese secret codes, which we had already begun discussing in our previous lecture. Recall that just before Poland was invaded and occupied by the Nazis and the Soviets, the Poles had given to the British and the French a tremendous gift: replicas of the German Enigma machines, which they had reverse-engineered through the work of brilliant Polish code experts. The British program to break the Enigma codes was called Operation Ultra. Its brain center was a red brick mansion 50 miles north of London called Bletchley Park. This housed the government communications headquarters. The staff at Bletchley, which eventually numbered 10,000, was the most amazing ragtag collection of mathematicians, linguists, chess champions, and eccentric university professors. Oh, but what am I saying? I repeat myself. It goes without saying that university professors are eccentrics of the first order. Many women were set to decoding tasks as well, seen as especially suited for attention to detail. They had been recruited by informal networks. They were tested by being told to do crossword puzzles at fast speed. And these women did a tremendous job of maintaining secrecy at Bletchley Park about their work in a largely self-regulating way. In many cases, these women kept the secrets long after the war was over, even from their own husbands. We only found out about the ultra secret in the 1970s, and at that point the full story emerged. But the secrecy had been maintained to a remarkable degree before then, long after the war was over. In spite of the tedious and mind-boggling work, many of the Bletchley women were glad to contribute to the war, given that there were so few other avenues open to women at the time. There was, moreover, not to be scorned, the shared thrill of achieving a breakthrough in the decoding process. Among the Bletchley experts was the brilliant Cambridge mathematician Alan Turing, who had already been a visionary. Earlier, he had proposed a brand new idea, a universal automaton, as it was called, a machine which would work mathematics by reading binary code, essentially the precursor to our present-day computers. For 5 years, the Bletchley Park operation decoded German diplomatic and military communications. The operation continued because the German experts remained proudly and obstinately convinced that there was no way that their high-tech Enigma coding could be broken. And this was hubris that led them to disregard any hints that there might be something that had gone awry. This intelligence proved to be vital in the Battle of the Atlantic. Because the Allies could read German submarine communications, they could route convoys away from where the wolf packs of subs were cruising. And Ultra was also key to Allied victory in North Africa. In a similar fashion, American decoding of the Japanese code, Operation Magic, delivered crucial information in the Pacific War. This intelligence helped during the turning point of the Pacific War, the American victory at the Battle of Midway. In April of 1942, decrypts of Japanese code indicated that Japanese planning was occupied with a particular goal. Those decrypts referred to a particular place, which the Japanese code named AF, that they were aiming for. And so now a crucial question arose. You could decode the messages, but if you didn't know what AF meant, you wouldn't be able to know how to use that intelligence. Where was AF? If this was the next object of Japanese military action, the Japanese could be surprised, but only if somebody could tell where AF was. AF could be Alaska, Hawaii, California, Seattle, or the little coral atoll island of Midway, 1,300 miles northwest of Hawaii, which had an American base on it. American military analysts suspected that AF referred to Midway, but they needed to be absolutely sure in order to be able to exploit this intelligence opportunity. American intelligence thus devised a trick. Radio operators at the American base at Midway were instructed to send a message in a code that the Japanese could pretty easily breach back to their American superiors, complaining that Midway's fresh water supply was running low. In short order, magic decrypts show that the Japanese were reporting that AF was running low on water, and this clinched the case and allowed the intelligence opportunity to be used precisely because there had been converging paths of circumstantial evidence. On June 4, 1942, when the Japanese Navy attacked Midway according to plan, the American Navy was waiting there and won the battle and began the road to victory in the Pacific. The question arises in this case, too, why did the Japanese not realize that their communications had been compromised? Just as in the case of the Germans' exalted confidence that their Enigma code machine was so technologically sophisticated that it couldn't be broken, the Japanese also held to similar beliefs. But these were further reinforced by an example of ethnic hubris, as the Japanese were also convinced that the Americans would not be able to master the complexity of the Japanese language in their decoding efforts. And this hubris turned out to be wrong. This is also a good place to introduce a skeptical note. Was intelligence alone winning the war? Was intelligence the real key to victory? Many historians today argue that intelligence alone did not win the war, but shortened the war, probably quite considerably. But the eminent British military historian, John Keegan, goes much further in his sober skepticism. Let's examine his argument. In a book entitled Intelligence in War, Keegan argues powerfully that intelligence was one factor among many. In the final analysis, he notes, victory is won through hard fighting and leadership, not by the silver bullet of intelligence gained by espionage or through SIGINT. Keegan examines, for instance, what others might herald as the perfect intelligence victory that we just discussed, the Battle of Midway, and notes that chance, as well as military superiority, played huge roles there too. Keegan concludes that intelligence in war is, finally, secondary and limited in its consequence. Keegan says, quote, "Foreknowledge is no protection against disaster. Even real-time intelligence is never real enough. Only force finally counts," end quote. Intelligence can sharpen the gaze of leaders, but all depends on whether the intelligence is understood, interpreted correctly, and used to shape sensible strategies. We would do well, even as we examine the myth of the spy in our course and all that spies and espionage are supposed to be capable of, to keep Keegan's skeptical note constantly in mind. Let's examine several more cases of covert operations and the use of intelligence and secrecy. A fascinating episode in the use of codes involved the famous code talkers, Native Americans serving in the U.S. military. Their languages could be of great use in adding a further level of security to military communications and had been used a little bit already in World War I. In ways, this was a remarkable reversal, by the way. In their schools, Native Americans had been forbidden to speak their own languages, while now, suddenly, they became extremely valued. The Marine Corps chose Navajo for use as the language to be used in the Pacific Theater, and there eventually were over 400 code talkers there. What few people know is that in the European theater, the Americans used Comanche speakers. The Comanche code involved creating terms that were much used in communications but not common in Comanche. And so thus, Colonel became Big Bird. Germans were our enemies. Paratroopers, appropriately, were jump soldiers. And my very favorite, very appropriately, Hitler was Crazy White Man. This was an intelligence success, as knowledge of these languages was very hard to come by for the Germans. An epochal, almost world historical failure to use good intelligence came with the Nazi invasion of the Soviet Union. Stalin had actually had many intelligence warnings that his de facto ally, Hitler, was preparing to invade the Soviet Union and simply disregarded them. These included American intercepts of German intentions that had been communicated by a Japanese official. These were passed from FDR to Churchill to Stalin, who ignored them. And another warning had come from Richard Sorge, a very effective spy in Japan at the time. The Nazis invaded the Soviet Union in June of 1941 in the largest land invasion in history, and Stalin seems at first to almost have had a nervous breakdown. Later intelligence allowed Stalin to appreciate that the Japanese were not going to attack the Soviet Union as well, so he could move troops to fight the Germans. In parallel with their military effort, Hitler and the Nazis were also mounting another covert operation of mass murder on an enormous scale. This they euphemistically called the Final Solution. What this term really veiled was mass murder. Ultimately, millions of Jews were rounded up, dispatched to death camps in the Nazi-occupied East, and destroyed. One of Heydrich's subordinates, Adolf Eichmann, became expert in the logistics of deportations. And secrecy was important to this program to the extent that anyone could really keep secret the murder of millions. First, not knowing their fate meant that doomed populations were less inclined to resist, although there was resistance. Second, even as many Germans and people in Eastern Europe near the killing sites knew the fate of the Jews, the Nazis wanted to stop the worldwide spread of this knowledge, lest international condemnation follow. A Polish resistance agent by the name of Jan Karski in 1942 came to Britain with news of the Holocaust as it was going on. And the news he brought was so terrifying to people in Britain and the United States that many found it hard to believe at first and take action. There were also some heroic figures who undertook action using secret methods. Amid the Holocaust, individual diplomats like Sweden's Raoul Wallenberg worked to save Jews, helping them to safety. While stationed in Hungary, Wallenberg gave out Swedish protective passports to Jews and gave Jews sanctuary in buildings that he officially designated as Swedish. He may have saved up to 100,000 Hungarian Jews, but towards the end of the war, Stalin suspected anyone who could be that good at covert operations and had Wallenberg seized when Soviet troops occupied Hungary. For decades after, his fate was a mystery. We now know that Wallenberg was taken to Moscow, subjected to torture, and poisoned. Stalin's paranoia had claimed another victim, a great humanitarian hero. As the war turned against Germany, a covert operation was planned, which might very well have changed the course of the war. And this was the 1944 bomb plot to kill Hitler. Some German officers, who had initially enthusiastically supported Hitler, were dismayed by the future before them as the war turned against Germany. Among those officers was Admiral Wilhelm Canaris, chief of the military intelligence branch, the Abwehr. Hitler had dissolved the Abwehr in February of 1944, so this branch of military intelligence had finally lost out to its rival, Himmler's intelligence apparatus. A circle of officers in the German armed forces now made the decision to break their military oaths of loyalty and to kill Hitler. The attempt on July 20th, 1944, almost succeeded. But Hitler ultimately escaped, although wounded. The revenge that Hitler took was ruthless. Canaris, who had not even been a central player in the plot, and at first had even rejected the idea outright, was among those who were suspected and arrested. And then, in the last days of the war, on April 9, 1945, he was executed by hanging with piano wire. In spite of such brutalities, the noose was beginning to close on Hitler and Nazi Germany, as new fronts were opened and Allied armies advanced. In mid-1943, as the British and Americans prepared for an invasion of Sicily in the Mediterranean and then up the Italian peninsula, British naval intelligence worked up a plan to deceive the Germans into believing that the real aim of the landings was not Sicily, but instead the Balkans, perhaps Greece. If the Germans could be fooled, their defenses would be stretched thinner, and the Allied landing could stand a better chance of success. This plan was called Operation Mincemeat, and this plan is also the scene with which we opened this lecture. Once the body of the alleged British officer had been recovered on the Spanish coast in a neutral country, German agents swooped in to photograph the contents of the briefcase, and they then passed the information to Berlin. A key question was whether the Nazis would believe the evidence. When ultra decrypts showed that the Germans believed that disinformation, Churchill got a telegram that tersely said, "Mincemeat swallowed whole." The operation was a success. That success was repeated for the far larger invasion of France in Normandy in the summer of 1944. The Germans knew that an Allied landing was coming, and they thought it must be aiming either for Pas-de-Calais, where the channel was narrowest between England and France, or the Normandy coast, more distant. The British mounted a massive deception campaign. This involved the creation of an entire fake army, the 1st U.S. Army Group, which was allegedly stationed in East Anglia, all to suggest that the Allied attack was actually headed for Pas-de-Calais. Dummy vehicles and buildings visible from the air were constructed out of plywood and cardboard, and a large volume of fake radio traffic was generated. This deception was tremendously risky. If a single German agent had penetrated Britain and had seen the real facts on the ground, the entire enterprise would have been blown. But then the landings in Normandy began on D-Day, June 6, 1944, at 6:30 in the morning. Even as Allied forces struggled ashore, German reserves, numbering nearly 300,000 men, had been kept at Pas-de-Calais, waiting for what they thought was the real invasion. And when these reserves were finally moved up, it was too late for them to be of use. From this point, the Allies, now from east and west, closed in on Nazi Germany. And Hitler, increasingly isolated and embattled in his bunker below Berlin, could only place his hope in Nazi secret weapons, the V-1 and V-2 missiles. They came too late to change the outcome of the war, but they were portents of a new age of warfare, potentially far more destructive than any before. And we'll discuss more about those missiles in our next lecture. After Nazi Germany surrendered in May of 1945, after Hitler's ignominious suicide, war against Japan continued until the dropping of previously secret and fearsome new weapons by the Americans, atomic bombs, on Japanese cities in August of 1945. To these portents of a completely new age of technological warfare, of potentially devastating impact, the Nazi secret weapons and the atomic bombs and the associated espionage, we turn in our next lecture.